Are you just stunned that I brought up Oprah and I related it to college basketball?
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold and all he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538, and with me across a brand new table, a real upgrade, is Neil Payne, sports writer and sports editor. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
Neil, our old table was sort of like something you would inherit from a great aunt.
Oh, completely.
Whereas this, it's sleek. It's got a radial wood grain pattern.
This feels like a reproduction of a very famous mid-century modern piece.
Oh, yes, the Eames table.
I think it's the Finn Jewel.
The Finn Jewel, very nice. That voice you hear is Hot Takedown student athlete emeritus Kate Fagan, also of ESPNW. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Chad. The first time I heard that word, I thought it meant like esteemed professor.
Emeritus?
Yeah, and so she's a professor emeritus. I'm like, so what do you teach? This is awesome. Where can I get? No, emeritus. I'm like, so you're really good at it.
No.
Just
so good that they retired.
Yep.
But that's same for you in your student athlete career.
That's why I understood what you meant, that I used to be really good at being a student athlete.
And where'd you learn that?
When Colorado.
You were a student athlete. Exactly. All right. On today's
what
show.
What percentage chance, Kate?
To get into Colorado?
No. To get into the college football playoff.
Okay, because
you've been tracking this every day.
30%.
Okay.
82%.
I thought it was like 40 last week.
I know. But
things
then
didn't break their
didn't
way.
Break their
but
way.
They're in the Pac-12 championship.
It's true, but
it's a fluid situation.
But Ohio State beating Michigan was not helpful. It's a bunch of ums. But the acceptance rate to Colorado is 80%.
Much higher.
I should also say I'm giving the commencement speech at Colorado this spring.
Whoa.
Wait.
Yeah.
That's
what?
Awesome.
Isn't that scary?
Commencement is the graduation one, not
it's
the matriculation
the emeritus
one. You are doing the whole college?
Yeah.
Kate, that's a lot of people.
I know. It's a lot of people. It was one of the I think I should have said no because it was scary. Then I realized you should say yes to scary things, so I said yes.
All right. So on today's show, we're not going to be issuing any commencement addresses, but you know who will be here to speak to us, guys? It is a big day.
Oh, yeah.
For almost 2 years now, Hot Takedown has been obsessed with one figure in the college basketball world. He goes simply by two syllables, KenPom. Today, Ken Pomeroy of KenPom.com will be on Hot Takedown and talk to us about men's college basketball. Very excited. We're going to be previewing the season that's sort of already
it's
well on its way.
And
talking about whether college basketball is broken and how to fix it if it is broken. And then we're going to talk about whether the women's college basketball game is broken as well and if it has the same sort of symptoms as the men's game, and then also where this year's UConn team versus the field argument that we've had, you know, ad nauseum on this show, what it's shaping up to be this year, as it seems to be a bit different. And then finally, we will return to the chess arena where the World Chess Championship is somehow still happening after weeks of play. The final tiebreakers are this Wednesday. 538's Oliver Rader will drop in and explain what to expect and what the chance that something called Armageddon will visit the World Chess Championship.
Wow.
That sounds heavy.
And then, for our significant digit, it's going to be about the New York Mets.
Yep.
Very excited.
Yes.
Very excited. All right. On to the show. We are a few weeks into college basketball season. The men's teams have played more or less six or seven games so far. We haven't talked about it yet on Hot Takedown, but it's one of at least my favorite things to talk about on the show, and with us to talk about it is the legend, Ken Pomeroy. Hi, Ken.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate the intro there. Very kind of you.
So let's begin with the league as a whole. What are you seeing so far this year? Are there trends that you've picked up even in these six or seven games that are different or that are sort of continuing trends that we've seen before in college basketball?
Well, I mean, the thing that I guess is continuing is that college basketball players are continuing to get better and better at making shots. I guess one of the kind of boring storyline on the one hand, but interesting as well, is that we're probably going to blow away the all-time record for free throw percentage this season. Currently, we're at 69.8% across the country, and the record was set last year at 69.96. And players do get better shooting as the season goes on. So, you know, if they're shooting that well at this point in the season, they're going to be shooting better towards the end of the season, and we'll probably end up, you know, in the upper end of, you know, 70.5 to 71, somewhere in there. And, you know, not the most exciting thing to maybe talk about, but it kind of flies in the face of, I think, kind of old school conventional wisdom that people can't shoot, whether it's, you know, the 3-point line or the free throw line. You know, players are really better than ever in terms of their ability to shoot the basketball.
And Ken, why do you think that is? Do you think that's like just a function of the composition of teams and lineups changing and kind of becoming maybe smaller or maybe more kind of shooting centric than in the past?
I think there's a lot of factors that go into this. I mean, certainly recognizing the value of the 3-point shot has helped in that. So, you know, as coaches have been more open to letting players shoot the shots, I think that players that want to shoot the shots have, you know, kind of felt more empowered to work on that aspect of their game more instead of, you know, maybe some of the other aspects of the game that were worked on in the past. And that's allowed players to become better shooters. You know, obviously 10 years ago, it was pretty unusual for, a 6'9 guy to take 3-point shots. But now it's, you know, almost expected that, you know, if you're playing power forward, you're going to have some ability to, step out and take a shot. So there's a lot of things going on, but I mean, certainly the evolution of the game to taking more advantage of the 3-point shot, I think, has driven the basketball playing youth to practice that shot more than they have in the past.
So Ken, I want to drill down a bit into individual teams. Your rankings on KenPom.com differ a little bit from the AP rankings, if I'm looking correctly. But what strikes me is that we've got a lot of blue bloods at the top, a lot of teams that you may expect. Duke, Virginia, North Carolina, Kentucky, Villanova, Kansas, Louisville are the top seven, and then Wisconsin, Syracuse, and Baylor. So these are teams that we're used to seeing as powerhouses. And I'm sort of wondering, that doesn't seem like a surprise. Every year we seem to have some arrangement of blue bloods, but do teams like Duke and Kentucky and North Carolina seem stronger this year than even some iterations that have been at the top in the past?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, Duke's kind of a wild card at this point because they have, you know, three highly touted freshmen who have yet to play this season due to injury. So this is not the Duke team that, you know, we expect to see in February and March in terms of who they can put on the floor. So so they're a little bit up in the air. I mean, they're still playing really well without those guys, but they'll be better down the line. North Carolina even has a serious injury they're dealing with as well, with Theo Pinson, who's been out. But based on what we've seen from them, they're probably, you know, they're certainly, I think, better than last year's team. Ditto for Kentucky. I mean, they obviously are rolling out a number of freshmen this year, but, they look very strong in early action. Kansas is a little more veteran laden, but, led, I'd say, by Josh Jackson, maybe the best freshman in the country, and he has lived up to his billing early on. So, I do think all four of those teams, you can make the case that by March, those four teams will each be better than they were in March of last season. And they were all pretty good last year. But I think, yeah, the top of college basketball, certainly with those traditional powers, is stronger than it was last season.
Ken, if we can take a broad view of the issue of parity within college basketball and try and understand maybe why there's more parity than, say, a sport like college football, but still not the kind of parity I think that, you know, casual fans like sometimes wish they had. What are some of the reasons that drive that, you think? Because it seems as if with college football, if you go to a up-and-coming school or any sort of mid-major, there's not a ton of upside because to get into a meaningful game, you have to be in the top four. And it's been like that even when it was BCS. So it wasn't like there was a field of 64 teams where you could be like, look, it's cool if you go to school at Butler because you're going to be able to get that shot. So it would seem like men's basketball would have more opportunity for some levels of parity because the field is wide open about who has this opportunity to win a national championship. So do you think men's college basketball has the kind of parity, more parity than football or comparatively, or what do you think drives either what you see as parity or a lack of parity in men's college basketball?
Yeah, Kate, I think there's really two kinds of parity in the sport. So one is kind of the short-term parity that, you know, anything can happen on a given night, and that's the kind of thing that can propel a team like Butler to, you know, make consecutive Final Fours or DCU to get to the Final Four. You know, those kind of runs where you have teams that are good, you know, among the 20 or 30 best teams in the country, you know, they can make it to a Final Four. And then there's kind of the long-term parity, which I don't think college basketball has a lot of. I don't know how to compare it to college football, but it might have a little more than football just simply because, you know, the nature of the game, one player can make a difference. But, you know, long-term parity, I mean, if we were going to, you know, sketch out a top, you know, 10 for, let's say, the 2022 season or something, you know, we have no idea who's going to be on those rosters, but we can be pretty confident that, you know, Duke and North Carolina and Kansas and Kentucky, probably three of those four are going to be in the top 10. So the long-term parity is probably lacking. And, you know, the main reason, and this sounds like a shot at amateurism, that's really not, but there's no salary cap, you know, in the college game. And spending on facilities, spending on recruiting, spending on private planes, the teams at the top are able to or do spend much more money on the basketball program than you know, a Butler or a VCU or a Creighton, or, you know, take any of these other very good programs that are kind of lurking at the bottom of the top 25. You know, they just don't have those resources, so they're naturally not going to get.
Right. And there's no such thing as a mistake. Like, you know, in the NBA, you see a team make a mistake and then they have 3 to 5 years till they can recover. There's no such thing as a mistake in college basketball, except if maybe coaching hire, right? Would be the only thing that might set a program back.
Yeah, and I mean, there's mistakes in recruiting, but you know, if you're Duke, let's say this year, and you have a, you know, 6-man freshman class, I mean, you might miss on one or two of those guys, maybe, but you still, you know, have four of those guys. And if you're continuing to produce top two and top three classes year in and year out, I mean, ultimately, those recruiting rankings do mean something, and they're not perfect, but a kid who's in the, you know, top 10 of his class is probably going to turn out to have a big impact on the game. And so, yeah, I mean, when you have essentially the first draft pick every year, you know, you're going to have a pretty successful team going forward.
Right. These bigger programs basically have redundancies built in a way that NBA teams can't, because they can recruit, you know, the top five folks or five of the top 30 maybe. So, Ken, I want to ask about a conversation that has been going on for a couple years now around college basketball, which is basically, is college basketball broken? Or as the New York Times Magazine recently put it, what's the matter with college basketball? The writer of this New York Times Magazine piece, who used to work for our former sister site, Grantland, J. Caspian King, wrote that there's a movement to make college basketball great again, that we had some rule changes. The shot clock came down to 30 seconds, for example, in an attempt to get more scoring. But as King points out, the difference between 63 points and 66 points, if you're watching at home, isn't necessarily that great. And he goes on to say that maybe we have too much college basketball on. And to your point, Ken, about parity, about long-term parity, one way to maybe bring that in is to have people become invested in more teams, or to have more money come into those teams, which means putting them on TV more. But what King argues is perhaps we're watching mediocre college basketball, and so it dilutes it when we do see great college basketball. And I'm just wondering where your head is at on this issue. You know, you've looked deeply at the stats about trends in scoring and things like that. Do you think there's one easy fix for college basketball if you think it's broken?
Yeah, I mean, I think we just had, you know, the biggest fix was, you know, finally dropping the shot clock to 30 seconds. And, you know, that spurred a lot of positive changes last season. You know, the possessions were up dramatically, scoring was up dramatically. And, you know, those trends have carried through to the beginning of this season. So I'm pretty happy with where college basketball is. That said, you know, the changes that college basketball makes to the rules, they're just, for some reason, they're behind the times by about 10 to 15 years. And, you know, college basketball just got around to dropping the shot clock to 30. And, you know, most of the world is now down to 24, basically, in every, you know, competitive league that matters. So, you know, I think if you want to improve college basketball further, that would be a way to do it. You know, there's some resistance to doing that because I think coaches of mid-majors generally feel like, well, you add possessions to the game and you're going to reduce the chances of upsets. But, I mean, honestly, I feel like if you reduce the shot clock, you're increasing the value or the importance of decision-making on the floor by players. And that to me, favors teams with more experience, and those are generally not your North Carolinas or your Kentuckys of the world. You know, those are the good mid-major teams. So, to me, there's a pretty good case that, you know, you drop the clock to 24, it'll make the game even more exciting, more interesting, and we'll improve it further. But just to be clear, I'm not one of these people that think it's broken. It certainly was headed that way 2 or 3 years ago, but the rule changes, cracking down on contact and reducing the shot clock have really helped.
So some of it feels like just the way people are looking at college basketball and perhaps looking at it through an old school viewpoint. And Ken, like you said, there's no argument to making and adjusting the rules that will continue to allow the game to evolve and alongside the game of basketball. But some of it is like, and I'll bring this back around, but it's like, I don't think we could ever have another Oprah. You didn't think I was going to Oprah, did you?
I've been listening to Making Oprah. Great podcast.
You didn't think I was going there. Like, we could never have another Oprah because, like, that's not how people consume television anymore. It's too fractured. It's we're on demand. You know the whole point here. And so that doesn't mean that there aren't hosts as skilled or as interesting or as warm as Oprah. It simply means that there's a difference now in the way we consume things. And this applies to sports in the way that it's not like college basketball, as it continues to evolve and the rules evolve with it, like, it's no better or worse of a game than it used to be. It's just that we're seeing more of it and we're looking at it and we have different options. And there's a lot of different cultural issues at play that I think are affecting then how we view college basketball. And then we're like, oh my God, it's broken and we need to fix it. When maybe it's not broken, maybe we just kind of need to readjust our expectations.
Yeah, I think it's a good point that, you know, expectations do matter. I mean, I will say that, again, the way things were headed a couple years ago, you know, the game was just continually getting slower and slower. And there's this natural, I think, evolution where coaches want to take more and more control over the game. And I understand why they do that. They want to win games. But from a spectator standpoint, it's not as appealing to see coaches constantly controlling possessions. You know, and with the old shot clock, it was just a little bit longer, but they could call plays. And if that play didn't work, they could call another play and the possession could drag out. And so I guess just to reinforce my point, which had nothing to do with Oprah, but you know, I do think any rules changes that allow the players to make more decisions and take the decision-making out of the coach's hands will make the game more interesting. But bottom line, yeah, I don't think the game is really broken at all.
Yeah, and one last thing that I thought was kind of funny from the Jay Caspian Kang story was where he said nobody could watch the, say, Duke-Maryland games of the early 2000s and argue that the game was better in a previous generation. Well, I distinctly remember there being, relating to Maryland, that 2002 team, when they beat Indiana in the final, people complaining Jared Jeffries and people like that couldn't make a jump shot when they were working out with scouts, and kind of having that be used as an argument that fundamentals are dead in college basketball in an era that's kind of being looked back on now that I'm old and, you know, that was when I grew up watching the game, as being, oh, well, things were so much better back then. So I do think that everything is kind of cyclical. And as we get older, we kind of have a tendency to look back at previous eras and kind of romanticize them, when at the time people were complaining and we kind of forget about those complaints.
No question about it. And I mean, that, you know, the free throw shooting, I think, is you know, emblematic of that, where, you know, you'll watch, I mean, you'll see broadcasts this year and I think the conventional wisdom from broadcasters who really aren't up on the stats is that, you know, free throw shooting is worse than it was in their day, and gosh darn it, you know, we made sure we could make free throws when we played, and it's so important and that kind of thing. And the reality is that, you know, the opposite is actually true. You know, players are better at making free throws now. And, you know, I can't speak to, like, are fundamentals better now than they were then? I don't know. But I do know that if people can miss on the free throw issue, which is something that is measurable, then it wouldn't surprise me if they're wrong about the fundamental issue as well.
Yeah, college basketball is this sort of volatile mix of potential for condescension, because it's not only do you have the sort of bias towards nostalgia and how things used to be, but you also have kids, and so, you know, or college kids, and so they must be doing something wrong or differently than was done in the past. All right, Ken, let's leave it there. Thanks so much for calling in. It's been really fun, and we'll hope to have you on soon.
All right, it sounds great, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Before we keep going with the show, let's get a word from one of Hot Takedown's sponsors. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by Blue Apron, the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service. Blue Apron's research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often, and they spend under $10 per person to do it. What do you get for those $10 per person? You get customizable recipes each week based on your preferences. You can choose from a variety of new recipes or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. And each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card with pre-portioned ingredients, and all of it can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. So what's on the menu in the upcoming weeks? Roasted pork and braised cabbage with barley and glazed apples. And what about Thai green coconut curry with sweet potato and jasmine rice, brown butter and chestnut gnocchi with Brussels sprouts and pea shoot salad? Sound enticing? Does it sound enticing for someone else? Because it's gift-giving season, guys. And Blue Apron would make a unique holiday gift. So you can check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals for free, or give your someone else's first 3 meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/takedown. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So do not wait. blueapron.com/takedown. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Okay, let's keep this conversation going about whether men's college basketball is broken, or rather college basketball overall is broken, by taking it to the women's game, basically. So we just spoke with Ken Pomeroy about how he thinks the men's game isn't as broken as being made out to be, the way that the rules have changed is sort of course-corrected, basically, for the sport. And, Kate, as we think about women's college basketball, which we've spoken about a lot vis-a-vis UConn and the rest of the field, basically, and I want to get to that in a second, I'm wondering, you know, when you survey the sport from up high, what are you seeing in the women's game?
From my vaulted position as ESPNW columnist. No, is that what you meant?
I meant sports at student athlete emeritus.
That's right, emeritus. Well, I think a lot of the same questions that have plagued men's college basketball over the last few years have also transcended and drifted over into the women's game. I mean, the NCAA issued a white paper on the state of women's college basketball trying to fix what they felt were some of the inherent problems in the women's game. And they mirror in a lot of ways the questions that have been brought up about the men's game in terms of, do they need to lower the shot clock to increase the pace of play? Do they need better fundamental teachers at, like, young levels? I mean, a big thing was, like, hand checking, those are all things we've talked about in the men's game, but, like, they have a much more urgent nature in the women's game.
And can I interrupt real quick to just say, one of the big differences is that in the men's game, you constantly hear about one and dones maybe being the reason and the cause for the game being lacking. You don't have that issue in the women's game nearly as much. But,
right.
But so it's interesting, I guess, to see a sort of a mirror image with one variable removed and still have those concerns.
And you still have the same question marks. And when I say that the sense of urgency in the women's game is bigger or more pressing is probably a better language than the men's game, is because people are talking about men's college basketball and perhaps how to make it better, but nobody's thinking it's going anywhere. Whereas women's college basketball, like, there was a lot of conversation a couple of years ago about how, well, okay, if a lot of the reason there's a lot of funding for women's college basketball is because it was the most obvious sport to fund when Title IX was introduced. And it was like, well, you have football and men's basketball. And so let's just fund women's basketball so that we check that box with our Title IX funding. Well, now you've got a bunch of programs around the country saying, well, we see that women's basketball is often a losing investment. If you're looking at it purely from number, it's a losing investment. The Women's College Basketball Championship loses the most money of any Women's Division I NCAA championship. And a lot of that is just the amount of money that goes into it. But then a lot of these programs and schools will go to the place of saying, well, softball rates really well on TV, and it does rate really well on TV. Women's soccer is super popular at the national team level, so maybe all of a sudden we start putting more of our Title IX dollars into soccer and softball and see if that ends up being a better investment for us. And so women's college basketball has the sense of urgency of, like, we have to do these things to fix our game right now. And part of that fix is, if you think it's a problem, is, like, you've got UConn, where the level of domination has not exactly inspired large audiences to stick with an entire game when it's a 30-point blowout at halftime. And so there's a lot of questions about what's good for women's college basketball.
What's good for women's college basketball? Where are you at with your own thinking?
Well, I think UConn is, in a way, setting the standard, and you're hoping that, as with every program, there's a dip. And I think even Gino is like, even the greatest things, you know, 50 years ago, 20 years ago, are no longer great. And now it has set a mark that will, you know, lift women's college basketball. So I'm not in of the camp that, like, women's UConn is terrible for women's college basketball. So I think that UConn is helpful. But I also am really, really excited for this particular season, when I don't think that the national championship is a foregone conclusion. And the rest of it is just rule changes. And I don't know that women's college basketball is ever going to escape the comparison to men's basketball, because it's been there for so long and because it's such an easy physical game to compare.
Sure. But, you know, I'm coming from maybe this is not a quantitative angle necessarily. But
I like that.
Yeah, I know. This is this is kind of a difference, the role reversal. But when I watch women's basketball now versus a generation ago, apologies to your generation.
Am I a full
Kate.
Generation ago?
I don't really know. How long is a generation in college sports?
Oh, because
it does.
No offense. You're definitely a full generation ago.
Really? I think
you're
a generation 10
plus
is like
years, right?
Yeah, it's been 12 years.
In sports, I feel
Yeah, how many recruiting classes?
Generations are 4
years. Okay,
year
you think generations. See, sometimes I'm like, oh, well, the last generation would have been like the 80s Indiana.
I'm saying in college sports in particular, generations are the number of years you can be.
So you think
the
they're 4 year generations?
Yeah.
Almost. It's certainly accelerated.
It's not a cultural
generation. I just want to make
also,
sure
you're
that
culturally
we're
generationed out too. Just
to make no mistake about it, you are old, Kate.
I'm not upset that I'm 35 and that I haven't played for 12 years. I simply was just pushing back on the language to make sure I understood it properly.
Right.
Don't take this as I'm upset that I'm old. Okay, Chad?
You've already accepted your emeritus status earlier in the episode.
Emeritus is how I said it.
Oh,
well.
Sure. Sorry. All I was going to say was that if you just apply the old eye test, which, you know, we're not always the biggest fans of here, but sometimes you can learn a lot just by watching, as Yogi Berra said. And in this case, I think, and maybe you'll disagree with me, Kate, but I think the level of skill and athleticism and speed and just everything is so off the charts compared to what it was even 10 years ago. The difference, I think, to the naked eye does not exist anywhere near as wide in, say, men's college basketball, where if you took a game from, you know, 10 years ago and compared it to now, it would be different. I'm not sure that you could kind of come to the same comparison point where it's like, this is night and day. I think you can in the women's game, especially if you watch, you know, the upper echelon teams. And maybe that's part of the problem that we've been talking about for a long time, is that maybe the upper echelon teams are able to stack talent, especially without the one and done phenomenon, and they're able to kind of build teams that have all of these sort of advanced players, and that's what creates the particular parity problem that we've talked about a lot. But just in terms of overall kind of universal skill among, you know, the best handful of programs, I think the players are far better. Quantum leap from where they used to be.
Right. Brianna Stewart would be the equivalent of like Anthony Davis normally.
Yeah.
And
oh,
so
yeah.
She would have been gone and you wouldn't have had to deal with the dominance that we just saw with UConn. And you're absolutely right about, I'm going to need a different phrase than eye test because I just cringe. So let's brainstorm about
that's a different
a synonymous
yeah, again, this
phrase,
is,
but we
this
don't
is new
have
territory.
To say the eye test.
Listeners helped us name non-consecutive dynasties way back when.
The Grover-Cleveland.
The Grover.
The Cleveland,
yes.
Right?
So can we come
and
up
so,
with a different phrase than eye test?
And so what would it be? What does it need to explain? Just like the gut feel once you look at something?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Listeners. Help
please,
us.
Something other than eye test, because it's like it's in the range of optics and narrative and problematic for
right.
me. Like all these things that are actually hollow. Now.
I feel like there might be something with like you know how when bougie people try wine, they'll talk about the mouth feel. There needs to be something like that around eye test that isn't quite as
bougie.
Mouthy.
Okay. But back to the point,
oh,
once
right.
we redefine the eye test, well, we just rename the definition.
We're
of the
rebranding
eye test.
The eye test.
Anecdotally. I remember playing college basketball and playing at a high level. And so for 4 years, playing against some of the top 10 teams and feeling like I could hold my own. And the year after I graduated, getting asked, because Colorado Springs is not far from Colorado and it's the Olympic training facility, getting asked to just come in for a scrimmage against the national team, like the under 21 national team that was going to play overseas for women. And playing against these players and being like, oh my God, I don't even know if I would get a scholarship if I myself.
Like 5 years before.
Yes.
Even though you were
yeah.
older and,
Yeah, I mean, at that time I was probably 23 and these kids were like 17 or 18, but they were like the best 17 and 18 year olds. And I was like, I would not play at the same level. And there's no, and that type of rapid evolution doesn't exist on the men's side just simply because of the longevity of the existence of the game.
Right.
And that's what would be imperiled if funding starts to bleed away from
right.
women's college basketball and towards, let's say, women's softball, because it's partly because of the funding that that you create the ecosystem that
yes.
that
so many young girls play
and
all that.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about this year's field, because UConn did not debut in the number one in the coaches poll. They're now ranked number two. They've only played four games, but they're without Brianna Stewart, Mariah Jefferson, Morgan Tuck, without a lot of the names that we're used to hearing over the last few years. It's in some ways the obvious question is this the year? We're not going to know, because especially without any forecasting model that we haven't put out yet at 538. But then I also think, well, they're still undefeated. It's not like there's been any evidence that they are ripe for the picking, aside from the fact they're not blowing teams out by 40 points anymore.
And in some ways, I mean, it's very funny if you look at we've used Jeff Sagarin's ratings when we've talked about the women's game in the past, and he always perpetually has Connecticut at like 10 to 15 points per game better than the next best team, or at least over the past few years, that Brianna Stewart team being kind of the apex. And right now, they're still like about 7 points better than number two Baylor, and then about 9 points better in the rating than South Carolina and Notre Dame, and they're number one. So they've, and this is based on games that they've played so far. So they're having the results. If you just had like kind of a naive rating that knew how good UConn traditionally is, doesn't know anything about all the personnel losses that they've sustained, and then kind of looked at how they played this year, your algorithm would be like, oh, nothing's changed. They are continuing on, same old, same old. The only difference there is almost like if we had a model to predict it, we could build this in. But now it's just down to the pollsters kind of mentally making the adjustments and saying, they don't have quite as much talent. But you're right, Chad. It hasn't really manifested itself in un-UConn-like numbers. And again, this is four games into the freaking season.
And my point is basically there's a difference between saying that things have been turned upside down or something's changed and something's tightened. And thus far, I don't see any evidence beyond that the field has tightened. But that doesn't mean that UConn isn't still paramount.
Right, or that UConn still won't win the
right.
title. And there also seems to be, maybe this is just my gut feeling around it, like an element of hope with some of these rankings and the people voting for them. Is
voter
like,
fatigue also.
Right. They're just like, God, I just don't want UConn to be number one. And even if you see them week after week, and you're like, oh, man, UConn's number one again. You're just like, but I loathe to vote them first. Except there seems to be an element of that.
It doesn't happen in college football with Alabama.
Yeah.
You know? Like that, I agree.
But there's not the same level of like dominance over – I mean, I know Alabama's dominant this year. I get it. But now I want to know, like, do you actually think level of dominance over the last 15 years, Alabama can touch UConn women's basketball?
No, definitely not for 15 years.
For
and
five?
Definitely, I mean, so no.
I mean, UConn just won
nothing
four
really,
straight
yeah.
averaging.
Again, nothing,
like,
yeah. I would say Alabama might be as close as there might have in modern history or like recent history there has been in college football to that UConn like run of just every year they are either winning the championship in the championship game or you know kind of in the mix at the end of the season it's a totally different level for UConn though.
It would be fun to identify all the UConn women's teams in all sports of history, you know, so like do the Jordan Bulls qualify,
right.
Do the Yankees of the 90s
of the
qualify?
As well. Yeah.
Like who is in that pantheon of UConn women's basketball?
I feel like it's like obviously it's like UCLA men's basketball.
Yeah.
And that's the one
and
that
the Celtics.
We always yeah. But like I also look at UConn as in a way kind of if you use like a restaurant analogy, like sure they don't have the great ingredients right now that they had the last 4 years. They've got like, they're not ripe yet. Right.
But or like, they have great ingredients and just truffles aren't on the menu anymore.
Right. Okay. That's
I'm really
a good
out bougieing myself.
Watch
you really are. But that doesn't mean that UConn and the factory that it has become is not going to turn that into a great meal. So we can all be hopeful if you're like a voter and you just desperately want someone else to be the champion this year. Be like, well, I don't see the kind of ingredients that I've seen in the past. That doesn't mean that come March, like UConn isn't going to have the best meal still.
All right. Let's leave it there. I feel like
We need a different phrase for eye test.
Yeah.
Come on,
there.
Listeners.
It's out there. It's something about – it sort of reminds me of the optometrist somehow. So something, could there be like a...
Well, it is eye-based, Chad.
Okay, yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to end this segment before I get myself in any more trouble. Let's leave it there. After 12 games at the World Championship of Chess, Magnus Carlsen and Sergei Karjakin, whose name I've forgotten to spell in the interim...
Okay, they sound like villains in a Bond movie.
That's fair. Are tied at 6 points apiece, and that means tiebreakers. Here to
yes.
talk about those tiebreakers.
Chess tiebreakers. Play for the tie.
And what's happened in the last 12 games of chess. It's 538's Oliver Rader who's been writing about it. Hello, Oliver.
Hello, Chad. How are you?
Oliver Rader is also a villain in a Bond movie.
Or an Indiana Jones, like, go kill the Nazis kind of name.
True. It's just because Raiders are the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
Anyway, carry on.
Ollie, have you always wanted to be a villain?
Well, I take all of those comparisons as quite the compliment, so thank you.
A villain would take that as a compliment. Mm-hmm. Ollie, just set the scene for us here. You have been at every game in this 12-game match. If I'm remembering correctly, you may have taken Thanksgiving off or the day before, but the point is that you have devoted yourself to these two men sitting around a table on office chairs that you've located at Staples. You've gone deep into their psyches, into their cushions. What have you learned about the state of chess?
Well, first I would just like on the record that I did not take Thanksgiving off and I watched chess all afternoon.
I'll note that in your annual evaluation.
So you can give thanks to me in turn, Chad. So this is the most important match on the chess calendar, and now it takes place every 2 years, and this year it's back in New York City for the first time since 1995. It takes place on a big floor of a building in Lower Manhattan on the East River. The players, Sergei Karjakin and Magnus Carlsen, play in a glass box, which is very reminiscent of a reptile room in a zoo.
Or a Bond movie.
And there's... Mm-hmm. Or a Bond movie, and there are, depending on the day, somewhere between 200 and 300 ticket holders wandering around, watching them in the reptile room, watching them
Two or three hundred. How many does the room hold?
I think, if I'm remembering correctly, 300 and change is capacity.
Okay, so it's not like a 1,000-seat auditorium. Like, this is like, sometimes it's filled.
Yeah.
It's intimate.
Yeah, they're not playing at center court in the garden or anything like that.
Okay.
Although that would be cool. There have been 10 draws out of the 12 games, and each competitor has won just one single game. But I think one of my biggest takeaways from the match so far is that not all draws are created equal. There have been some very perfunctory draws, like game 12 took 35 minutes, and there was very little of interest to report. But games 3 and 4 were absolutely epic, stretched into the late evening hours, and saw big swings in advantage. Carlson looked like he would break through. He's the heavy favorite, but Karjakin, the Russian underdog, has built sort of impenetrable fortresses out of his pieces, and his amazing defense has really kept him in this match. And yeah, now on Wednesday afternoon, we are off to tiebreakers.
And so can you just describe those tiebreakers? Because it is a fascinating escalation of intensity as it keeps going, and I'm wondering, whether the way that the tiebreakers unfold favors one competitor over the other.
Sure. So I think for a little context, the pre-tiebreaker games, the regulation games, each player gets 100 minutes to start, and roughly about an hour of bonus time as the game goes on. So these can stretch for 6, 7, possibly even 8 hours if they really kind of took it to the limit. But now things get quite a bit quicker. So in the first section of the tiebreakers, they'll play what's called rapid. So each side will get 25 minutes for all of their moves. So the rapid games will take something like an hour total. So they'll play a kind of mini match of four of those games. If that is still tied, they will go from 25 minutes down to 5 minutes aside, and they will play a series of two games with 5 minutes aside. So they'll switch. One player will get the white pieces, and then we'll get the black pieces in the next game. And if those series of five-minute games are still tied, the final ultimate deciding thing is called Armageddon. And I'm not making this
Larry
up.
Very Bond movie.
And in an Armageddon chess game, the player with the white pieces gets 5 minutes. The player with the black pieces gets 4. But if the game is drawn, that counts as a win for black. So that is the final sudden death deciding game format in the tiebreaker.
And wow. Black moves second. That's why if they hold serve, basically, then not hold serve, but return serve, then they win just by drawing.
So if someone's only education on chess was, say, the movie Pawn Sacrifice, how accurate of a knowledge of chess would that person have if you've seen Pawn Sacrifice based on the Bobby Fischer chess match in Iceland, I believe? Does that make sense? Yeah. Is I don't know if you've seen Pawn Sacrifice or not, but is that an accurate representation? Is this sort of like a Hollywood rapid fire excitement, or is it an in between? Have you seen Pawn Sacrifice?
I have not seen Pawn Sacrifice, but I will say that many journalists have been going out of their way to sort of mold this year's match into the sort of Cold War battle that was represented in that movie. So Bobby Fischer was the first American world champion. He took on the Soviets, basically, kind of all by himself from an apartment in Brooklyn, and he beat Boris Spassky, who was the top Soviet player. So there's a bit of that kind of East-West sort of dynamic kind of trying to be applied to this year, and I guess in this case, Norway is the West and Russia is the East, despite the fact that they actually share a border. So I don't think I answered your question, but I there it is.
No, yeah. There was additional information, and I'm pleased.
Yeah.
So Ali, who's going to win? You know, are there? We talked last time that we spoke to you about how ELO comes from chess, the ELO that we talk about all the time around football and basketball and whatever else. Okay, you weren't with us then, but we spoke about sort of the history of ELO a little bit. Can ELO forecast whether Carlson or Karjakin is likely to take it home?
Yeah, so I ran some simulations with the two players' ELO numbers at the beginning of the tournament, and they kind of fell in line with what the bookies were saying, which was that Carlson was a huge favorite, something like 85% favorite. And, you know, that didn't pan out. He, you know, some of the top grandmasters who are watching are saying he's kind of not playing up to his potential, and Karjakin's defense has been incredible. But if you sort of run those numbers again, in advance of the tiebreakers, Carlson is kind of a similarly large favorite, 80% or so favorite. And Carlson has had very, very good results in rapid and blitz tournaments recently. He's actually the reigning rapid world champion, and rapid is the format that they'll begin with on Wednesday. So I think Carlson has a distinct edge. Can Karjakin find another way to stay alive? Only time will tell.
Now, Ali, does the fact that Karjakin was able to kind of drag things out this far against the number one player, does that suggest that something like ELO was, or even the bookmakers, now that you mention it, were kind of off? Does this mean that Karjakin is better, Carlson is worse? You mentioned that Carlson is not playing up to his potential. Does that mean he's not performing the moves that, like, for instance, I think we've talked about this, that the computer analysis would have suggested he played, or getting himself into worse positions than he should have been? Like, how has that manifested itself, and did we learn something from these past 11 matches, even though they're kind of tied now?
Yeah, Carlson has left winning edges on the table, for sure. In games 3 and 4, there's a chart in my story from this morning that kind of shows the computer analysis as those games go on. And you can see that Carlson had very winning positions in both games 3 and 4 and just couldn't quite find the winning sequence of moves that the computer had found. I'm hesitant to read too much into just a couple games, but I spoke with Fabiano Caruana the other day, who's the number 2 player in the world and the top American, who said to him it seemed like Carlson had some sort of psychological block and that he wasn't playing the moves that he would usually play. So there's some rumblings that maybe Carlson is a bit off his game. Maybe Karjakin is, you know, having a great couple weeks just to kind of stay even. I don't have a great answer, but I think, you know, it's clear that these two players are much, much closer than people had thought 2 or 3 weeks ago.
All right, Ali, I think let's leave it there. We'll let you get back to your obsessive studying of these two player strategies as you prepare for Wednesday's Armageddon, potential Armageddon, I should say. Oliver Rader, thanks for talking to Hot Takedown.
Thanks, Jen. Thanks for having me.
And now it's time for our significant digit, when a telling number from the world of sports drops into our laps. There was a shiver of excitement.
It shot up and down our Slack channels.
And you could feel it in the air in the office.
It came through my text channel.
Everyone.
From Big C, my dad.
Everyone was buzzing and shivering.
He spelled Cespedes wrong, but he was excited.
About Yoenis Cespedes, who signed with the Mets, the first big deal of the offseason.
Yeah.
The biggest fish in the offseason, if you believe athletes are fish. And 4 years, $110 million reported. No trade clause, $27.5 million per year. The largest contract ever for the Mets. Not sure if that says more about Cespedes or the Mets not spending any money ever.
Well, you know, Bobby Bonilla is still available. So
and still being paid. So I did what any right-thinking Mets fan who knows Neil Payne would do, any co-host of Panic City, the premier Mets podcast about Mets fans' emotions, would do. I slacked Neil and I said, Neil, is there any way we can figure out how good Yoenis Cespedes has to be to live up to $27.5 million a year, given how old he is and everything else? And Neil said, Chet, do I have the research for you? You didn't even have to do the research yourself, Neil. Someone else had done it.
No, no, no.
You did it.
I slacked it to, or I tweeted it to
a reader. Do you think that everybody knows
reader.
What slacked means?
Slack is an in-office messaging program.
It's a team communication service.
It's basically like you IM'd it to him.
Yeah, basically.
Anyway, the significant digit, Neil, what do you got for us?
So the significant digit is about 12.5 wins above replacement. That is the amount of production that Cespedes will need to offer over the next 4 years, the 4 years of his contract, in order to justify $110 million, which $110 million over 4 years, 27.5 per year, that sounds like a lot, at least to like those of us who are grew up watching baseball through, you know, the 80s and the 90s and so forth. The market value for baseball players has gone up significantly to the point where, you know, a player making $27.5 million a year, that was pretty much what A-Rod was making when he was the highest paid player in baseball. Now, it won't make you the highest paid player in baseball. You may not even crack the top five. I'm not sure what the exact number is, but the thing is that the value of a win above replacement has skyrocketed, and we can kind of expect it to continue to do so at kind of a predictable rate. And so that means that Cespedes really only has to average about 3.1 wins above replacement per year in order to justify the $110 million over the next 4 years. And for reference sake, he had about 6 wins above replacement 2 years ago, and he had about a shade over 3 last year. You know, he's going into his 30s, so you would expect a little bit of a drop off from that. So it's a tad bit of a rosy projection, but it's, you know, not outlandish to expect him to hit it. I would say the mean projection would be about 11 WAR over the next 4 years, which would give you a market value of about $95 million. So maybe the Mets coming out a little behind, but it's a pretty reasonable contract, which I never thought I'd say about $110 million.
It's like mergers and acquisitions where when a company buys another, you have to pay a little premium over what the market cap is.
We're really talking ourselves into this, Chad,
especially when you're not paying your pitchers anything.
That's true.
That has nothing to do with like some company that's getting bought, but like
resources
they had
have to
a
go
bunch
somewhere.
Of, yeah, they had a bunch of money because their pitchers are like getting paid nothing. So
yeah, and they
now
got
just,
you know got what
now
got
they,
what you pay for in the injury department.
Can go get some awesome bullpen as well.
Great.
I don't want to say a person's name because I just can't advocate for this specific.
Familia. I'll say his name.
No. I don't want Familia.
Oh, we certainly don't want Chapman, if that's what you're saying.
I just want a really good bullpen.
Who has not
here.
Abused anyone.
Right. That's what
increasingly
I'm saying.
Difficult to find.
Right.
Yeah, baseball. All right. Well, I feel like I have a full podcast of Cespedes thoughts
sure.
to say, which, you know.
May happen.
If I may. Neil, you want to do a little emergency Panic City pod?
Let's do it.
All right.
Okay, bye, guys.
Coming later this week, we will talk Cespedes on Panic City. Our sort of semi-official spin-off pod of Hot Takedown. So tune over to that if you are interested in hearing more hot stove thoughts about the Mets. All right. I think that's it for the show. Right, guys? You feel good?
That's right. I feel good.
All right. So let's... Kate, thanks for chatting about sports.
Thanks, Chad.
Neil, the same goes to you.
Thanks, Chad. And I also want to thank Kate for this wonderful Oregon swag that she brought for me.
I brought a bag of swag. Ooh, from lots of schools.
It is chartreuse green, the sweatshirt that Neil's wearing. It has
chartreuse.
A large...
You're very bougie.
...duck. I'm just trying... Woo, this has been a firing squad today. Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. Our podcast emeritus... It doesn't quite work, does it? Podcast producer emeritus, which he is...
Yes!
...is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think and... what the term should be for eye test going forward. You can also tweet at us at various platforms. Kate, are you back on Twitter?
No. I'm
Do
reading
not
books
tweet at
instead.
Us. Actually, all three of us have a very complicated relationship with Twitter. So email us, podcast@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcasting app, also on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538, all spelled out. Be sure to review and or rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.